1888 Podcast Network.
New year, new programs. If you like listening to the How, the Why, check out our new podcasts, including the Hero's Journey podcast, hosted by Jeff Garvin and Dan Zarzana. Listen to Jeff and Dan study character through the lens of Joseph Campbell by breaking down your favorite books and films. Go to 1888.center/podcast to listen, or subscribe at iTunes. I did.
I'm John Barrett Ingalls, and this is The How, The Why, presented by 1888. Every week, we connect with artists, authors, and innovators in the world of publishing and literature to discuss their creative process and creative purpose, and explore the evolution of the industry. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get connected.
Hello and welcome to The How, The Why, brought to you by 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today it's my pleasure to be connected with Jeroen Lifschitz, the artistic director and CEO of Circa. Jeroen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure for me as well. I've watched many pieces on video. I'm looking forward to seeing your production of Il Ritorno at Chapman at the Musco Center for the Arts in January. Thank you so much. I would love to talk about your beginnings as a visionary, as a stage director. I'd love to find out, like, what productions you saw, or what really brought you into the concept and the longing to be in stage production.
Look, I actually got into theater because of like all great stories, really, because of Pretty Girls.
Of course.
yeah, I mean, if you think about, you know, it's a story that, you know, starts the Trojan Wars and it starts the Bible, the expulsion from the garden. But in more prosaically, it starts my somewhat, interesting career in theatre. I was studying to be an academic, and there were just all these pretty girls kept walking through a door. And I thought, I want to go through wherever that door is.
Oh, I know that door.
It's called the door to the theater.
Yes.
So I went in there. I felt what I loved about theater is I'm a very messy person, and I fell in love with the order, the kind of creating this little world where things worked and there was structure, but it wasn't artificial. And I just did something about it appealed to me. I caught it like a virus. I'd never really seen a show that I particularly liked. In fact, most of the time they just bored me. And I think it's a little bit like being a writer. And many writers I know say that you write because you can't find the book you want to read.
Right.
I think I make theatre because I can't find the show that I want to make. Now, that having said that, I was watching in my hometown in a fairly an era ago. Subsequently, I've discovered, much to my shock and horror, that the world is full of extremely talented people making wonderful work and far beyond the capacity that I'll ever have. So ever since then, it's been a mad scramble to kind of figure out how to fake it and keep up.
So in the educational process, the longing for the feminine connection brought you through the door, but when did you discover, oh, this is what I want to do, and I'm actually good at that?
Look, the want to do it was an instant, was a kind of love at first sight. I think love is essentially a kind of olfactory thing. You love the smell of it. I just love the smell of the theater, and I haven't left in 30 years. I'm nowhere am I happier than in a theater. Good at it. The theater is a very hard and demanding mistress. I don't think one is ever really good at theatre. I think you're chipping away at a series of essentially intractable problems, and some of them are really technical. How do two people communicate with each other when there's an audience out the front? Which is the problem of cubism and perspective and framing, to rhythm and authenticity. And when you get it right, it's the simplest, most obvious thing in the world, but getting it right is well nigh impossible.
Did you start off as a performer, as most do?
I tried. I mean, I'm a heroically bad actor. So, but I did it to learn about it. And at school, we studied acting. what I learned was if I'm any guide, you definitely can't teach an actor.
Sure.
Because I certainly was never going to learn to be able to perform.
So you think it's something that you're either gifted with or not?
Look, I don't know about gifted. I'm just definitely anti-gifted.
Sure. Okay.
I mean, some people are kind of proactively bad at stuff, which is a different level to not being a savant. I'm a great believer in what you need is enough talent to start, but not enough to excel easily. I think that's the ideal way for being really good at something. Also having a great compulsion or desire to be good at it. That's a really healthy place to come from. That's where I come to theatre from. I've got enough talent and knowledge to get by, but I'm not a naturally gifted theatre maker, so I have to work at it, and that helps.
But you have a vision, and obviously this has been something where you can see, you can either take up a piece, an opera or a play or a piece of physical theatre, and you can see it laid out in front of you. And that's something that not everybody is gifted with as well, or even slightly gifted with.
Yeah, look, I think there's something in there. What I think I get is a kind of feeling about what the work should feel like from the inside, a kind of wavelength, a sort of harmonic that I can feel. And I'm, when I'm directing well, I can be dogged in ensuring that is delivered on stage. Hmm. Or try to ensure it's delivered on stage. Sometimes you can't, though. And it's, I think when you make a piece of theatre, you really have to sort of leap into the unknown, and you will fall back on your tricks and your own cliches. You will become your own concept album and cover band, but you're going to try not to. And at every point you're faced with your own inadequacies and fears, and that is absolutely healthy in making art to everybody except the person who's doing it, for whom it's excruciating, and probably also the people who have to live with the person who's doing it, for whom it's definitely excruciating, because making a work of art is hard. And it's not hard because it's kind of just complicated and big. It's not hard in the way that doing a huge Excel spreadsheet is hard. It's hard in a kind of, are you actually... You're creating something, and it's Promethean. You're actually kind of stealing fire from the gods, and that's there's a huge presumptuousness in that.
I'm curious about with your knowledge and your academic history in stage direction and production, what was it that led you to the physical theater and more specifically the circus theater?
That's the easiest question in the world to answer: boredom. Hmm. There's a line in The Simpsons where Homer goes to see a bear in a sort of shabby adventure park, and he says, "I've seen plays that are more interesting than this. As God is my witness, plays." when I heard that, I went, I completely agree with you. I've seen shabby bears that I just do not, and I trained as a theatre director, and I had this kind of moment of crisis thinking everything that I like about theatre is absent in a play. I just don't think, I think plays are, I mean, I quite like plays as abstract things, and when I see, you know, a brilliant play immaculately directed, I have a great night in theatre. But it seems almost incidental to the words. That's and the kind of the form of a play. Great, you know, great theatre to me very rarely looks like a play, even if it is based on one. So I just wanted something that was more real, more electric. I didn't understand why a group of people should recite lines that they didn't write, pretending to be people that they aren't, telling me a story I wasn't interested in.
So then, Circa.
Yeah, well, what I was particularly interested in wasn't the physical theatre. I was interested in something that was based in a particular, fairly small set of languages. A friend of mine described writer's block as an experience where you open the door and inside the door you see the whole universe. Hmm. I think for me, theatre's a bit like that. I know that we can do a stripped-back verbatim production and we can do a singing, dancing, show tune, show number. We can do anything in the theatre. So why would you choose to do one thing, not another? It's a kind of writer's block. And for me, working in circus rather than in physical theatre or you know, conventional theatre gave me a very limited set of languages to work from. There's not that much that happens. You can do acrobatic balances, various forms of aerials, juggling balances. You know, there's a sort of a skill set and a range, tumbles, and from here you can develop, you can spin out. So I quite liked having a fairly minimalist sort of data set or language set to work from. And I was very influenced at the time by the writings, more than the stage work, but the writings of William Forsythe at Ballet Frankfurt. Hmm. He really said, oh, you know, I'm trying to create contemporary ballet. It's not contemporary dance. I'm working with the traditional languages of ballet, but I'm transforming them into something new. And that really resonated with me. There were three companies in Australia. One was a sort of contemporary opera company, one was a puppet company, and one was a circus company. And the job for the circus company happened to come up first. And I've been here ever since.
Now tell me about your time there. I mean, you definitely have made your mark and really made this your own. What was it when you started as compared to where it is now?
Look, when I started, it was very small. There were three people in a room. It was kind of, not much had been going on for a while. And I think we've grown it into something where we have, you know, a couple of groups working around the world where we perform a lot. We do about 400 shows a year around 15 or so countries. We have an opportunity to work on a range of projects, festivals, and you know, outside projects and all sorts of things. So it's obviously kind of not gone too badly. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. But mainly we have a sense about who we are in the world, which I think when we started we didn't. The company that I came into was called Rock and Roll Circus, and it had been immensely important in Australia in the 80s and mid-90s, developing a kind of adult-based contemporary circus. So it was sort of one of the first circuses that was like tough, energetic, adult, you know, not afraid to be risque or dirty or, you know, grungy. And it just kind of, that had gone, as you can understand from Rock and Roll Circus, it sort of just outlived its time. People kind of got that about circus. I came in and was like, well, I'm not really interested in rock and roll. I'm much more interested in classical music. I'm not really interested in circus per se. I'm interested in this language that we have called circus, and I want to kind of I want to deconstruct it and explore it. So we renamed the company and found a way to work, which is not prescriptive. It's not a methodology exactly. It's a bunch of assumptions and learnings and kind of corporate and artistic knowledges that cohere sometimes into a way of approaching the work that we do in the world around us.
Yeah, it's interesting too. Like you said, this concept of adult contemporary circus. There is this element of our cabaret. Or like burlesque almost. There's a sensuality to it.
Yeah. Look, I mean, circus is inherently pretty sexy. I mean, you generally have underdressed, exceptional bodies doing things that mortals like us can only dream of, and I'm not sure I include you in that, but I'm going to assume. So I mean, inherently it's pretty fabulous and sexy. I mean, we have a couple of different sort of strands of work. We have our main stage work, which is things like Il Ritorno. We have our children's and family work. We tour a show, for instance, called Carnival of the Animals. And we have our post-cabaret work, where we deliberately kind of tackle that burlesque and new variety and cabaret work head on and kind of mess with it, but can kind of straddle it as well. I think that world, you know, I mean, we first really encountered it full on with La Clique in like 2004, I think. That was really fresh. It's become now almost a sort of cliche, the Spiegel tent with the show with the young people in lingerie grinding around. But in 2004 or so, when La Clique started, it was kind of really radical. Like, nobody had thought that you could just kind of take these things, throw them together and have an amazingly good night. And it's kind of transformed our world. It also, you know, added challenges to it, because I sadly have find a young person dressed in lingerie grinding around to be probably the least sexy thing there is. I'm often not a very wholesome version of what I think sexuality or intimacy could be. And I'd like something very different with my life.
It's interesting too, how many shows, because you have an ensemble of over 20 something performers, and you have all of these different touring shows happening simultaneously. Are there people who participate in multiple shows, or are they individual casts for the specific show?
They learn about between 5 and 10 shows each, depending on which group they're in. Yeah, it's complicated.
It seems like it. It seems like a lot of moving pieces, and then not even to talk about the technical properties of it as well. It's very impressive, and I would love to like kind of get into how you develop a show, and I'm sure that is a quite a long story as well, but I'd love to take Il Ritorno, since that is coming soon to Southern California, and I'd love to just talk about from concept to execution.
Yeah, look, Il Ritorno had a particularly interesting and torturous journey. The short answer is there is no method that works for every show. But there are a few things that you can learn. I think having a good idea is, to start with, is probably pretty good place to start, something you connect deeply with and feel needs to be done. Il Ritorno was based on a very old idea, which was of mine, which was to connect Monteverdi's great opera Il Ritorno di Lissima Patria with the plight of modern day kind of refugees and, you know, the sort of homeless, the rootlessness that infests our globe. That wasn't a particularly deep, well thought through idea. It was just a sort of a strong impulse. And I kind of decided to do a sort of semi stage version of Il Ritorno as staged by a group of Italians returning home, interpreted via Primo Levi. It all sounded like a good idea at the time, until I put it on stage and it just didn't work. And I looked at this thing and I went, there were lots of things about it that I liked, but there were lots of things that I thought were just a mess. So I hurriedly remade the show in a couple of weeks whilst doing other performances on stage in season in Montreal. And in 3 days back in Brisbane, I commissioned music from 4 different composers. I threw out 3/4 of what we'd made, and we remade the show and then kind of opened it fairly triumphantly at the Barbican in Jan, sort of a couple of months later. how we made the show, though. So that's the kind of the big arc.
The small arc
is the things that work in our world are things that create a physical reason to be doing something difficult and often dangerous, and connect that to a strong emotional life that the performer and the audience can share. And if you think about an oyster, it gets a grain of sand. The grain of sand irritates the oyster into producing a pearl. My job is to basically be the grain of sand.
Hmm.
My job is to say to an artist, here, let's try that without using your arms. Let's try that and see how slowly we can do it. Well, let's see how we can do that and stay on the, you know, can you keep moving all the way through doing that? And sometimes they're emotional tasks. Sometimes how long can you do that without showing me any emotional content? So there's a whole variety of different approaches to that that I think in a way give us, you know, allow me to sort of enter into different worlds and kind of pursue different threads. Working with an ensemble, we have a shorthand. It's a bit like work, you know, the old joke about the mental asylum where the patients have been together so long that they can do the jokes by the numbers. It's like we talk in this kind of almost short, you know, shorthand dialect that nobody from the outside world can understand, but it means we can take a very simple idea very far. In Il Ritorno, it's complicated by opera singers, music, Monteverdi, words. It's a much more kind of difficult proposition to drive through.
I'm also fascinated by your ability, and you kind of just touched on this, of bringing emotionality out of these, they're like athletes, acrobats, but they're so emotional. And, you know, and I haven't seen it live. I only got to see this on video, and I was still feeling the emotion. I'm sure the music helped with that and the light design, but like there is definitely like, what is it? How do you work as a director? You know, I've studied theater. How do you work as a director to be able to pull emotion out of someone who is more inherently a physical performer?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. I don't think there is particularly a simple answer. I think what we do basically is I think with emotion you feel it. It's kind of, it's an authentic test. I'm really interested in what that emotion, what genuinely happens to us emotionally when we feel something, and I like the authenticity of the emotion. The best response to me from an audience member is I felt something very strong during the show, but I'm not sure what it is. That tells me we're on the right track. I don't like things that are – I don't have a literal bone in my body. It's one of the reasons why working with a text like Il Ritorno is complicated for me, because it wants you to do certain things to tell a story in a particular way, and I'm not very good at that. What I was interested in was this certain particular emotional quality. Getting it into the performers is not really a case of getting them to feel it, but rather getting them to undertake tasks and inhabit states that cause that feeling to emerge in the audience and sometimes in them. And that's kind of just a matter of doing it and having a look.
I'm also curious too about, with such a small ensemble in a production, like you have in the touring production six performers, is that correct?
Yeah.
What happens when there's an injury? It's such a physical show and so physically demanding. How do you compensate for something like an injury? God forbid that would happen.
Oh, it happens. Look, it happens from time to time. We our practice is improvisational. We can work around most things. We have artists we bring in where we really need to, but we could, you know, we've been able to get through shows. We've started shows with, you know, there was one legendary run where we started a performance with seven artists, finished it with six. Not a Il Ritorno, but a previous show. Started with seven, finished with six, started the next night with six, finished with five, started the next night with five, and finished with four.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the next three nights we had three different combinations of five back on stage. Look, it's what we do.
Right.
Yeah. football teams play with what they've got. They have bigger ensembles. You know, you just kind of work with what you've got. You cut your cloth. When everything's going great, it's relatively easy to be really good. Yeah. When it's the test of who you genuinely are, it has an awful lot to do with what you do under pressure and what you do when things don't run well. So,
do you notice that there's a different connection with the live music with your performers?
Oh, absolutely. And it takes a while. I mean, we find that there's a little bit of time at the beginning, and then all of a sudden, the musicians start to listen to the acrobats start to listen to the musician, and something else cooks. I love live music. We happily use it in every production, but obviously it's expensive and it's cumbersome, and you have to tune pianos and transport harps and buy plane seats for cellos, and none of that's particularly lovely. But hey.
I'm looking at your schedule now, your touring schedule, and it looks like you have six shows in rotation. You're about to launch another one, Peep Show, in 2018. How do you personally, I'd love to, you know, this is going to be like a numbers and minutes conversation, but how do you balance everything? How do you organize everything for yourself?
You don't. You genuinely just keep going. I mean, I love what I do. So I have no issue finding the energy to do it. It's just finding the time and the organizational space. And there's no way to really do that except to just, you know, like eating an elephant one bite at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a great kind of tendency I notice in a lot of the younger people we get through, not so much the artists, but more the arts administrators, to want to have, you know, the killer app or the system or the piece of software that's going to do it. And in my experience, it just doesn't exist. What you do is you start at the beginning, you work as hard as you can, you get to the end and realize you've kind of forgotten a few things, and you do them just before you crash into a oblivious sleep before you wake up the next morning and restart the process.
And it seems where you are now, the process just has to happen. Like it's going to happen whether or not. That's just a wheel that's turning.
Look, it might look like that from the outside. I have to say that every production and every that we do involves a lot of people believing in it,
mm-hmm,
and contributing to it. And we can't take any production for granted. Every time we convince a venue to accept one of our shows, a programming committee has taken a punt on it. They, you know, they've taken a gamble. Somebody's fallen in love with the show. They've had to convince their superiors, had to convince their superior. Circa is far from the easiest sell in the world. You know, we aren't just you have to start by saying, well, there's an opera. It's 500 years old and features people, and it's not really the opera. And then they're doing circus. I mean, you know, that's not an easy lay down the air kind of sell. Yeah, it's like, hang on, but there's that other show with the girls in lingerie. Let's get that one. You know, like that one's easy. Yeah, it's kind of sexy and cool. This one's like weird and hard, and you might feel something. And, you know, so I think what we, you know, it's just important not to take for granted the kind of the number of people who have to take a risk and have to believe in what you're doing to achieve that. I've been very humbled by the people who have and continue to take risks. So that for us, there's absolutely no sense that this continues just by itself, because it does. It continues because the efforts of it, the extraordinary efforts of our team, and the kind of the belief and trust of our partners and collaborators and, you know, supporters.
Yeah, I was going to say your lighting design and stage design, the Jason Orgon has put together for all of these. Again, I've only get to see the clips, and I look forward to seeing it live, but like, it's pretty incredible. And I could tell that it is about a team. It is about a team, and with something that's so physical, there has to be the trust in the team.
That's right. We all have to work together, and we also have to be able to make shows that work under very difficult conditions, different conditions, from tents to big theaters. From, you know, we come from a long way away, so we can't afford to have huge patches of downtime on our touring. We come from Australia. It's a big flight. It's expensive to keep companies on the road. So, you know, we've prided ourselves on being kind of flexible and responsive and adaptable, and those are good qualities, but they're also qualities that mean what you can do is, you know, you have to learn to play to your strengths and work with what's available, and that's been part of our, I think, part of our achievement.
I'm curious too, with every new show, you create new shows constantly. What is it that you find inspiring?
I think it's more like I'm a beaver, you know, you've got to kind of keep eating logs to stop your teeth growing. I just for some reason have to keep making shows. There's no single thing I find inspiring about those shows on kind of mass. I think I find a particular, you know, I think a good show comes from a kind of an itch you need to scratch, and I feel an itch. It's one show it might be music, and one show it might be an idea, and one show it might be a kind of physical vocabulary, it might be a particular artist. It might just be an opportunity that then itches, you know, creates its own kind of itch. But it's the scratching that makes the difference. It's the ability to kind of go, I'm gonna push into it and apply a great deal of cognitive and emotional energy to make something beautiful.
Well, from what I've seen, everything has been beautiful. And I look forward to going to check out Il Ritorno. I want to let everybody know that Il Ritorno will be at the Musco Center for the Arts at Chapman University on January 23rd of 2018. Yaron, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
This has been The How, The Why with John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The How, The Why theme music was composed and performed by Dan Record. Please consider supporting 1888 and our mission. Become an 1888 advocate by purchasing our books, participating in our programs, and pledging today. For more information, visit 1888.center. That's 1-888-DOT-CENTER. I want to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.
For more information about the 1888 Podcast Network and all of our educational podcasts, you can visit us online at 1888.center/podcasts.